Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup on The Exchange. Here in the Granite State, we like to say our election is first in the nation, and it is when it comes to primary elections. But the Iowa caucuses take place Monday, and candidates have shifted their attention there for the most part. But here, there has been news relevant to the primary. Concord businessman Steve Dupree lost his seat on the Republican National Committee. So what does that say about the state of the Republican Party here in the Granite State? While some candidates are in Iowa or in D.C. for the impeachment trial, surrogates make the rounds in New Hampshire, and not all of those surrogates are human. And about halfway through the program today, Senator Amy Klobuchar will join us from Washington to talk about her policy positions and take your questions, which you can send now by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Right now, we're going to talk with a panel of folks who are in the know. National political reporter for the AP, formerly based in New Hampshire, Kathleen Ronan, CBS reporter Nicole Skanga, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you all very much for being here today.
Thanks, Peter.
Hi.
And we have some news this morning that we should break down a little bit. We learned recently that Congressman John Delaney has dropped out of the race. I want to get your take on his campaign. Maybe we'll start with you, Dean. John Delaney, running for a really long time, dropping out just before Iowa.
A really long time, going back all the way to 2017. One of the first individuals that we saw in state engaging in retail politics, setting up an organization within the state, never really got traction despite doing all the kinds of things you expect candidates to do in New Hampshire. Not sure that he got much traction in Iowa either. Perhaps decided it was just a time to drop out before the actual voting kicked in. He was on the debate stage, I think, at least once or twice very early on, but we haven't seen or heard much from him since. But he has been very active in the state and also in Iowa. It just for a variety of reasons, he did what you're supposed to do, but that doesn't always guarantee that you're going to get traction.
Nicole.
Well, the congressman said this morning that he was concerned that he wouldn't reach the viability threshold for Iowa, that 15% that you need in order to attain delegates. And his campaign put out a statement that said, quote, John does not want the good work of his campaign to make it harder for those like-minded candidates on the bubble of viability in many Iowa precincts to advance in the Iowa caucus and garner delegates. So perhaps a vote of confidence in other moderate candidates not wanting to get in their way. He was in this race for 918 days, not that we're counting, but that is, as Dean mentioned, about 2.5 years, and did make a play here in New Hampshire. I was at his 100th event in New Hampshire back last year, way last year during the summer, and really tried his hand at retail politics. And oftentimes when we talk about if retail politics are still effective, it brings us back to conversations about the kind of campaign that Congressman Delaney ran and his inability to get traction.
Okay, so John Delaney out just a few days before Iowa. Let's turn to something on the local political spectrum that has some national implications. So longtime Republican committee man and Concord businessman Steve Dupree lost his seat on the Republican National Committee this week. He was defeated by Chris Egger. Dean, for those who aren't familiar, give us a little civics lesson here. What is the committee man position? Why is it important?
Well, each state GOP, each state Republican Party sends representatives to the National Republican National Committee, the RNC, really the governing the national governing body for the Republican Party. And you know, the way it works is each state typically has three representatives, three committee persons sent to the national committee. The state chair is a member of the national committee, and then there's one committee man and one committee woman sent as well. And these folks will join and chair various subcommittees dealing with everything from the platform to the primary and caucus schedule to the rules committee. So it really has to deal with kind of the administration of how the national party moves forward. It really is the connection between the Republican National Committee and the state, the individual state Republican parties. And Steve Dupree, who has been a fixture in state Republican politics for many decades, was in his fourth term. He did 2 4-year terms in the 90s. He was in the second of his of two terms here in the 2000s. And he was what most people consider an upset. He lost his seat
Chris Egger.
Chris yes. Egger, yeah, who's the chairman of the Hillsborough County Republican Party. And so it was a surprise to a lot of people. You know, there are a variety of reasons for why this probably happened. The, you know, the state party has become Trump's party, much in the way that the National Republican Party has become Trump's party. Steve Dupree has been closely associated with John McCain for many years. He's more moderate on abortion. So for a variety of reasons, there was kind of a feeling with sort of the core members of the party that maybe he was no longer the best person to represent the party at the national level. He has been instrumental in protecting New Hampshire's first in the nation status. That will now fall to Mr. Eggers to pick up that mantle. Juliana Bergeron is the committee woman who was reelected. So she'll be going back as well.
Kathleen Ronan.
Yeah, I think something that really stuck out to me in this race was, despite everything that Dean is saying about the party kind of becoming Trump's party and Steve maybe not having a natural place in that, he did have the endorsement of Corey Lewandowski, who was, you know, President Trump's campaign manager. I think that came through maybe about a week ago, and it surprised me a little bit to see it.
And Governor Sununu, actually. And Governor Sununu endorsed him as well.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the reasons that Corey was with him, the stated reasons were that Steve, you know, had in 2016 done quite a lot to ensure that there was a fair playing field for President Trump and made sure that he got to stay in the debates and sort of backed him up. And so he had this support coming in from Corey, but it still wasn't enough, you know, with the core Republicans to sort of keep him in that place. And I also saw a lot of or a number of prominent Democrats after Steve lost Kathy Sullivan, who is in a similar role with the Democratic Party, you know, coming out and saying that Steve has really been instrumental in maintaining the first in the nation primary. And, you know, without someone like Steve in that role, what happens to New Hampshire? I don't, you know, I certainly don't think that all of the weight of New Hampshire's first in the nation primary was weighing on Steve Dupree's shoulders. But it is interesting, especially as we're starting to have these conversations about, is this the right order for the primary states to be in, to have, you know, someone like Steve sort of not be part of that conversation anymore.
Right. And a lot of the, you know, a lot of the maneuvering that goes around preserving the first in the nation primary are things that, you know, are conversations, are relationships that he's developed over a very long period of time. So in some sense, you know, Chris Eggers will have to kind of build back up that sort of seniority and knowledge base. And, you know, we're looking at what I mean, President Trump has generally been a fan of New Hampshire. I think the Democratic side is going to be a lot more complicated this time around. But I think we're looking at another cycle where there probably will be challenges to the scheduling for 2024.
Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments or things that you want us to address today on the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Also this week, Tulsi Gabbard spent some time in New Hampshire, one of the few candidates to do so. She was not detained in D.C. By the impeachment trial, as some of the senator candidates were. She spent time talking to voters, snowboarding a little, Nicole, as far as
snowboarding a little bit, yes.
Not a far cry from the surfing that she talked about on this program, being a fan of.
New Year's Day surfing, yes.
So you've been following her campaign a little bit, and you've been writing for CBS News about her campaign and how there is some appeal for her among voters who voted for President Trump last time around. What do you make of that?
Well, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard has all but moved to New Hampshire. She has spent 34 days there just in January and last December. But what her fans say, they say two different things, something about the Democratic Party and something about the general election. A number of them are former Trump supporters. Some of them are Obama Trump supporters, what we like to call pivot voters, real coveted, highly sought after voters among the Democratic contenders this time around. But she's having trouble sort of attracting more of those Democratic Party stalwarts. She has attracted folks from both sides of the political spectrum. I spoke with former Trump senior advisor Steve Bannon, who called her an absolute rock star. I spoke to former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who's a real progressive who also really loves her. So she sort of attracted folks on both extremes of the political spectrum, but is having a harder time appealing to just plain old Democrats who come year after year to vote for her. And here in New Hampshire, I've actually met a number of Republicans who have turned out to her events, who are attracted to what she is saying about ending forever wars. And that's a problem for her because they can't actually vote for her in the primary. That said, you know, recent polls have her around 5 or 6% with Democrats, but closer to 20% with independents here in New Hampshire. And as we know, independents can grab that Democratic ballot on February 11th if they want. They can cast a ballot for her. And so she's really been putting all of her eggs into this basket, spending a lot of time in New Hampshire, hoping to appeal to those voters. Will it be enough?
And she was the lone Democrat in Congress to vote present on the impeachment votes. And when you talk to voters, Nicole, do they have anything to say about that?
I think overall, voters are just a little frustrated by the impeachment process. Those that are in favor of it feel strongly that the president will remain in office regardless of, you know, what's been happening this week with the impeachment proceedings. She has gotten a little bit of pushback here or there from voters who say, yes, but, you know, it sounds like a political move, you voting present. And was that just the most politically advantageous move for your candidacy? But that seems to be more of the exception than the rule.
Dean?
Yeah. So Tulsi Gabbard is somebody who had not been getting a lot of attention, had not been particularly visible as a candidate until Hillary Clinton a while back pointed out that she seemed to be getting a lot of favorable press from the Russian media and suggested that she was in some way being groomed to be some kind of Russian asset. And then there was a discussion about whether or not she might launch a third party run, which Democrats were very concerned about, much in the same way they were concerned about Howard Schultz running as a third party candidate, the CEO of Starbucks as well. So this got her a lot of attention. Is she going to run a third party race? And if she gets a couple of percentage points, could that throw the election for President Trump? And then Hillary Clinton, comments, and now she's suing Hillary Clinton for $50 million for defamation for making that suggestion. So this has gotten her a lot of attention. I don't really know what her end game is. You know, she's probably not going to finish any higher than sixth or seventh here. And this is all her eggs are in this basket, as you said. So I'm interested to hear what's her plan? What's her strategy? She has said she's not going to do a third party run. I'm not convinced yet, but I may be convinced if she continues to say that. So we'll see. But it's been kind of a bit of a sideshow. I understand the voters that have gravitated towards her. There certainly is a niche for her here in New Hampshire. But her main visibility has been driven by this back and forth with Hillary Clinton.
Speaking of campaign strategy, this week Politico ran an article titled "Why Biden Scaled Back in New Hampshire." Former Vice President Joe Biden has not been in New Hampshire as much as one might expect, given that he's not detained by the impeachment trial of the president. Of course, you know, it makes sense to also be in Iowa a lot, but not as much in New Hampshire. But first, I don't know who wants to take this question, but in anybody's view here, has Biden really scaled back?
I would say that he's not been on the airwaves since the beginning of this year. And so that's something that's noteworthy, right? He is not. I think he made one ad purchase for just under $100,000 here in New Hampshire.
And is that small potatoes, basically?
Compare that to the $1.7 million he has made in Iowa. And now, notoriously, New Hampshire has a tough media market, right? The Boston media market is really expensive. You can buy out in Portland. You can buy in Burlington. So it's a little tricky. But he has scaled back in terms of his advertisements. And if you compare him to some of the other candidates, Joe Biden has spent 17 days in New Hampshire. Compare that to Senator Bernie Sanders, who, despite the impeachment trial, has spent 27 days here. Compare that to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who from the start of this race has spent 32 days here. And I keep track every time they come into the state, clearly. And so he's not been spending quite as much time here. That said, obviously, he's up against two neighboring senators, right? The senator from Massachusetts, the senator from Vermont. So perhaps that's strategy. And perhaps his campaign feels that if he has a strong showing in Iowa, that will give him the bump he needs here. He also has a castle, so to speak, in South Carolina that he's built, sort of a safeguard, some really strong support down there, especially among the African-American community and out in Nevada as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think broadly the sense with Joe Biden is that he is one of the candidates that does not need to win Iowa or New Hampshire. He may not even have to come in first or second in Iowa or New Hampshire because he seems poised to do well in South Carolina and the South more broadly. Once we start getting to these contests where the electorate is a little bit more diverse, that's where Joe Biden's base is. That's where the campaign believes his base is. And so I think that it's not exactly surprising that he's sort of, you know, not feeling like he has to spend all of his resources in New Hampshire. That said, at least the polling that we've seen, you know, he still seems to be he's up there in contention for, you know, first, second or third place in New Hampshire. So it in some ways, you know, I've only been back in town for a few days, so it's hard for me to tell exactly if he's scaling back or how to compare. But I think that there are New Hampshire's not quite as critical for him as it may be for some other campaigns who aren't showing that strength in the South that Joe Biden is planning to sort of ride that wave.
Yeah, we've been for the last year we've been talking about how Joe Biden's campaign isn't quite firing at the level that it should be firing, but nonetheless he manages to be first or second-ish in most of the polling. I think Nicole's data is very instructive, so he has been here a little bit less. It's also the case that he's not a big rally kind of guy. You don't get the kind of stories like you've gotten for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren where you see, wow, you know, thousands of people showed up for some big rally. That's really not how he is operated. He tends to do more medium to small rooms, maybe quite not as many events as some of the other candidates in succession. You know, some people have said that he's missing an opportunity here, given our primary structure where independents can vote in either primary. He might have an opportunity to appeal to moderates and independents here. But I think Kathleen is right. I think they see a longer game for him than just these first two contests. And, you know, the Monmouth poll that just came out yesterday, the day before, had him in Iowa up 2 over Bernie. So, you know, and that's only one poll. I've seen plenty of polls that say that Bernie's ahead in Iowa, but he's right in the thick of it, even with this constant perception that maybe he's not doing quite as much as he should be.
So a little bit of emphasis on the later voting states for Joe Biden.
I think so. I think they believe that they can afford to make it, you know, certainly a little bit further than those first two.
What about Andrew Yang? Entrepreneur Andrew Yang has spent a great deal of time in New Hampshire, and recently we learned he's going to be making the debate stage, the debate in New Hampshire scheduled for February 7th. Nicole, what do you hear about what voters are saying about Andrew Yang?
Well, Andrew Yang has spent the most time here out of pretty much any candidate. Certainly now that Congressman John Delaney is out of the race, he was here first in the Granite State, went to high school here, talks a lot about his time at Exeter. And a lot of these non-ideological voters, live free or die voters, so to speak, have been attracted to his campaign message and the way he sort of crunches the numbers. I was at a house party for undecided voters last night, and one voter told me, look, I'm tired of politicians sort of pandering to me or my group or my demographic. I want a candidate who can rally folks around good ideas. And so we'll see just how many people come out for Andrew Yang, just how much support he gets here. But certainly, given the independent streak we've been talking about in New Hampshire, he certainly has an opportunity to beat expectations in this state.
Listeners, we're talking about the week in primary news, and your voice is perhaps the most important voice on this program today. So we'd love to hear from you about what you think we should be talking about, whether you're still making up your mind and what information you need to do so. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about endorsements. We'll talk about Mike Bloomberg, about polling, and about dogs. There are dogs in the news this week. How can we not talk about that? Again, the phone number, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. By the way, we'll have Senator Amy Klobuchar on the program about half past the hour, so stay tuned for that and send your questions for her to us now. Email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
I'm Peter Biello, and this is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup on The Exchange. Joining me today, national political reporter Kathleen Ronayne, CBS reporter Nicole Skanga, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Listeners, now is your chance to weigh in. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org, or watch the live video of this radio program streaming now at NHPR Exchange on Facebook. Just go to Facebook, search for one word, NHPR Exchange. So this week, the union leader and the Keene Sentinel endorsed Senator Amy Klobuchar for president. Klobuchar will be joining us on this program in just a little bit. So again, if you got a question for her, email us, exchange@nhpr.org. But right now, Dean, that UL endorsement, what to make of it?
It was a little bit of a surprise. It was interesting to see. You know, they're basically making the case that she is best positioned to win in a general election in a way that the other candidates are not. You know, we typically like to think about the UL in terms of Republican endorsements. You remember in 2016, they did not endorse Trump. They endorsed
John Kasich.
And then I think in the past they, I think in 12 maybe they endorsed Newt Gingrich. I remember that got him a lot of a bump up in the polls briefly. So yeah, you know, it's certainly part of the mix. We've discussed here before on the show whether or not endorsements really have that much clout. I mean, I do think they fill a role for kind of signaling by political elites and kind of seeing who has a little bit of momentum. But in the end, I think it's just part of the larger dialogue. But I'm sure they were surprised, and it kind of gave her additional access into the news cycle as a result. But yeah, we typically think of the union leader and look to see who they're going to endorse on the Republican side.
So maybe one endorsement, it's nice, but when they start to pile up, I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah, it could be. And again, it depends on the outlet that is doing the endorsing. But you know, we talked about the New York Times and split endorsement with Klobuchar and Warren, and you know that dominated the news cycle for a day or two, but in the end, I don't think endorsements are decisive. But it was interesting to see them pick Klobuchar. It kind of fits in with the momentum that she seems to be building.
Are there any other big endorsements, like big newspapers that we're sort of waiting for, or
The Monitor's not doing an endorsement.
They're not at all.
They're not. Okay. No, which I learned on the NHPR podcast. Yeah. So they're not planning on endorsing.
So don't hold your breath for a Monitor endorsement. Okay. Let's talk to listeners who've been giving us a call. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk to Lewis in Plymouth. Thanks very much for calling, Lewis. What's your question or comment?
No problem. Hi. Yes, I'm an Andrew Yang supporter, actually, from Plymouth. I'm someone who actually voted for Trump in 2016. And Andrew Yang's message has come through really clearly to myself, as well as several other independents, libertarians, conservatives. And for that reason, I do think, as your guest had said, that I do think he is going to shock in some of these Iowa and New Hampshire votes coming up, just because I think a lot of his supporters, like myself, aren't people who are showing up in these polls, as a lot of the polls are kind of covering folks who are existing Democratic voters, but I'm ready to vote in the primary here in New Hampshire, and I know that there are several others like me out there. And I think we're going to surprise come primary day coming up very soon.
Yeah, and Lewis, what was the policy position of Andrew Yang's that sort of locked him in for you?
Absolutely. So a year ago, if you told me that I'd be for a candidate who supported universal basic income, I would have laughed myself out of the room, actually. Actually hearing Andrew talk about it originally on the Joe Rogan podcast was kind of what got me hooked on it. He's got a clear way on how to pay for it, which was my number one concern. And then thinking about what $1,000 a month would do for people all over the state of New Hampshire and all over the country who are struggling, it would enable them to essentially get the boot off their throat and make it so that they can do the things that they want to do in life, make sure that they're not worrying about their basic needs so that they can do things. I'm a small business owner. I just started a business in the last year here in the state, and boy, I'll tell you, it'd be a lot easier. I work other jobs while starting my business here, and it'd be a whole lot easier for me to get my business going and grow it if I knew that my basic needs were going to be covered.
Great. Well, thanks, Lewis. We really appreciate it. Let's also talk to Jonathan in Manchester. Jonathan, thank you very much for calling.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. With all due respect, your record of your panel for predicting the polls, I feel like deja vu from 4 years ago. You guys were wrong then, and I feel like you're so off now. If I had been as wrong, I would not be working. You know, I might lose my job if I was as wrong as you guys are.
Okay, hey, thanks very much. We appreciate your call. So we're wrong about polls. It seems like we might have some opinions about that on this particular panel, yes?
Well, you know, there are a lot of polls. You know, compared to when I started doing this 25 years ago, there just seems to be a huge influx in the number of polls in this particular cycle. They are to some extent all over the map. Although we always encourage people to look at averages, real clear politics as an average that a lot of people refer to, and certainly in the Democratic primary here in New Hampshire, the average has Sanders first, Biden second, and Buttigieg third, with Warren fourth. But you can always find a poll that's gonna give you a slightly different outcome if you look hard enough for it. You know, in terms of predictive ability, you know, polls are really snapshots. You know, I think he mentioned the last election. I think the national polls that predicted Hillary Clinton winning the popular vote were pretty much spot on. The New Hampshire polls were pretty accurate. The one area I think caught people by surprise is the Midwest and this sort of narrow loss by Clinton in the Electoral College. So I don't think they're that far off. But again, there are a lot of polls. People tend to self-select on polls that reinforce their prior beliefs, which can be problematic. So I always encourage people to look at averages and trends. Not you're always going to find one poll that makes you feel really good or really bad. Sort of ignore that urge to lock in on the result that you want and go with the trends.
I think two things when it comes to polls. The first is that it's just one piece of a larger pie. So that's why we're also talking about the time that these candidates have spent in the state, the number of endorsements they've gotten. We also sometimes look at how many staff members do they have? How many boots on the ground do they have? How much are they door knocking, right? That's all part of this conversation. The other thing to consider about the New Hampshire primary this time around is just how many voters tell us that they're undecided. Specifically, when you do look at some of these polls, like a recent UNH CNN poll that says about half of likely Democratic voters are still trying to make up their minds on this. And so, you know, this election, like past elections, could be unpredictable. Of course, New Hampshire is always ripe for a surprise. But this is a historic level of jostling between these candidates. And so it's important to keep in mind that really anything could happen.
And I would like to have heard from Jonathan who it was that he believes is being neglected in the polls. I mean, it's kind of the implicit underlying message of what he was saying is that there's somebody out there who is being written off who shouldn't be written off. Now, we won't know who that is, but that's just a guess. It would have been interesting to hear.
And Lewis had said, too, that he doesn't feel like the polling is reflecting the support for Andrew Yang that's
exactly
out there. Let's comment a little bit on someone we haven't really spoken much about on this program, and that's former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He was kind of foregoing the early voting states, but he did make a stop, stops in Vermont and Maine. Nicole, you were covering a little bit of that. What happened?
Yeah, absolutely. And so he's now finished visiting every single Super Tuesday state, which is really saying something. He visited both Vermont and Maine, flying over New Hampshire earlier this week. And it's also interesting to see just how much staff he is really putting into some of these early voting states that come after sort of the first four, the Super Tuesday states. So he has 15 people roughly and three offices out in Maine, he told audiences. That's more than the Trump campaign has currently. He also had a bit of an awkward encounter with a dog in a coffee shop in Burlington, Vermont. So really just shows you how many opinions the internet has.
So wait, what happened with the dog?
So we were in a coffee shop. He came in. He spotted a dog of a voter, went to sort of pet the dog, but instead took the dog from the snout, I believe you would call it, and
yeah,
sort
muzzle.
Of just,
he shook
it a
like
little
a hand.
Bit.
He shook the dog's muzzle.
Had
like
a bit of a rough time.
It's a great video.
I'll see myself out. I think what's interesting about it is the debate that it sort of sparked, and some people saying, "Oh, look at this guy; he's out of touch." Others saying he's just a dog person. But you know, always looking for a good.
As a longtime dog owner, it could go either way. Either he didn't know what he was doing and he was risking getting bitten, or he was so comfortable with dogs that he was comfortable grabbing them by the muzzle. Could go either way.
Kathleen?
Well, so I've been spending some time with Michael Bloomberg on the trail. I have not seen him have any strange interactions with dogs, but we got a long way to go. But he, you know, he's a really interesting candidate. What he says is the reason that he's skipping the first four early voting states is that by the time he decided to get in the race, which is late November, they're just, you know, by his rationale, there wasn't really time to sort of build up the type of campaign and the type of relationship with voters that these candidates, you know, John Delaney, others, Sanders, Warren, have been doing for pretty much a year. And so he thought, you know, I just don't have time to credibly compete in these places. And so he's really throwing everything on to Super Tuesday and hoping that he can make a big show on March 3rd. As Nicole said, just the magnitude of staff that he has in some of these places is really incredible. And we've never really seen, well, one, we've never seen this skip the first four and just go to Super Tuesday. It's never worked before. It's never been an effective strategy. But we've also never had a candidate as rich as Michael Bloomberg doing it. He's worth an estimated $60 billion. So he could spend billions of dollars and, like, really not feel it that much. And so it's fascinating. And we just did a story at AP earlier this week where, you know, my colleagues in, I think, like 11 of the 14 different Super Tuesday states contributed reporting that just looked at the breadth of what he's doing. And we've got observers, people that have been involved in political campaigns for a long time, just sort of marveling at the breadth of what he is doing and the money that he is spending and the advertisements that he is putting up on TV. He's got ads up in Utah, which someone said, you know, that's unheard of in a Democratic primary, especially at this stage of the game. And so I think that he has the potential. He's a total wild card. We don't know if he's going to, I mean, effectively, like, rewrite the primary playbook rules if he does surprise, or it could be a total dud and he could be out, you know, several hundred million dollars and that could be it. But it's really going to be fascinating to watch because no one's ever done it at this level before.
Mm-hmm. Allow me to correct myself. We mentioned earlier that we were talking about the endorsements for the UL, and I offered that John Kasich was the endorsement for the union leader in 2016. I was wrong. That was Chris Christie.
It was Christie. Okay.
So my apologies for that. I regret the error. I want to bring in some listener comments as well. Someone wrote in to say, David wrote in to say that Deval Patrick is doing many events, including a CNN town hall in New Hampshire. He's also doing some advertising in the state. Deval Patrick, former governor of Massachusetts. Also, Janice in Putney, Vermont, wrote in to say, I'm concerned that with so many candidates on the ballot, no one will emerge as a clear candidate with a decisive lead. Will this erode enthusiasm for the election, and what will it mean for the convention? Kathleen.
So before we get to the convention bit, I was talking with former Governor John Lynch yesterday, who's been out on the trail for Joe Biden all week, and he was at an event up at Franklin Pierce University or over at Franklin Pierce University. And I was asking him basically to set expectations for Joe Biden on primary day. And he said, you know, he essentially wouldn't say where he thinks that he needs to place. But he did say, you know, with so many candidates who seem to be relatively close to each other, we might have this scenario where everybody gets bunched within, you know, 1 or 2 percentage points. And then I'm paraphrasing, but his quote was essentially something like, I don't even know what doing well means. You know, if you have that many candidates that have the potential to be really close together, somebody will be the winner. But, you know, is that a victory? I don't know. And I think, you know, we're going to see in Iowa next week, we might have a similar scenario where they're going to be announcing essentially 3 different sets of numbers: who gets the most delegates, who has the most voters that turn out on the first go, who has the most voters after realignment. So we could have this really confusing scenario where multiple candidates are claiming levels of victory. Ultimately, you know, does that take the party to a contested convention? I think we'll see. But I think part of maybe what her question is demonstrating is that there are still some wounds in the Democratic Party from 2016 and people feeling like there may be an inability to unite. But I think some of those questions are hopefully going to be answered pretty soon when we start to see what the results in Iowa are, New Hampshire, or South Carolina. And we'll start to see if there really is, like, a breakaway frontrunner or two, or if we are in a scenario where, you've got four people that are cracking that 15% threshold needed to win delegates.
Nicole.
I do hear that from voters all the time that say they are waiting for a standout candidate and they have not yet found that candidate. I actually am curious, Kathleen, because you've spent so much time in California. We forget that California has more delegates than all of these early states combined. And so we could see a contest that really comes down to Super Tuesday. That's part of the reason, as we were talking about Mayor Michael Bloomberg, why his strategy is so interesting, because this could be a delegate fight at the end of the day.
Yeah, California has 415 delegates that will be awarded based on the results. And like every state, you've got to hit 15% in California. But you know, Bloomberg, Bernie Sanders are investing an incredible amount of money in California. Bernie Sanders has long talked about it, not as the first four, but as the first five, California being that fifth state. He's had dozens and dozens of staff members on the ground for a long time. And so I think the thought, you know, when California moved its primary up to March 3rd, part of that thought was, we want to be a player. We have so many delegates. We want to be decisive, and we think we have the potential to be decisive. I still don't know exactly what's going to happen, because I still think you could have that scenario where a lot of people, top 15, you know, top 15%. Only Bloomberg and Steyer are on the air in California right now. It's notoriously expensive to run television ads in California. But that, you know, California wants to be a player. It wants to really influence this election, and we'll see.
And there's, you know, there's traditionally been a pressure within the parties to wrap things up as quickly as possible so that they can heal any potential wounds within the party and get unified for the summer convention and the general election. But as you said, this may be the case where a handful of candidates are fighting it out well into the spring. You know, we saw Obama and Clinton in 2008 go all the way to the convention. Could be that scenario again, maybe less likely to be like John Kerry in 2004, where he wrapped it up very quickly once Iowa and New Hampshire were over. We just don't know. And that's this really, of the last seven or eight that I've been involved with, this is among the most fluid that I've seen.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, Super Tuesday has about a third of all delegates that will be awarded. And so while the first four are really about momentum, right? Getting that narrative that you're in the lead. Super Tuesday really does have the potential to be fairly decisive just because of how many delegates are at stake.
And just real quick, to the point of coalescing around one candidate, we're seeing something interesting play out in Iowa right now, where you have campaigns reaching out to other campaigns to form alliances. So, for instance, reports show that Biden's campaign has reached out to the campaign of Andrew Yang, meaning that if on that first go around, caucus goers don't reach viability or that 15% threshold to sort of show their support for their candidate, they would then defer to that second candidate that has formed that alliance. And so that's sort of something to watch, too, as we consider, you know, who will be coalescing around, but also which candidates might sort of form these alliances to try to unite the Democratic Party.
Listeners, in just a little bit, we'll be speaking with Democratic presidential candidate Senator Amy Klobuchar. Just to let you know that we did offer her and other candidates a full hour forum style conversation, but this was the only option that would work for Senator Klobuchar. So we're going to make the most of our time with her. But send your questions by now by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call now and stay on the line, 1-800-892-6477. I want to thank our panel of analysts and reporters for being here today. National political reporter Kathleen Ronan, CBS reporter Nicole Skanga, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you all very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Again, listeners, give us a call if you have a question for Senator Amy Klobuchar, 1-800-892-6477. This is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Simply put, NHPR's growing community of loyal contributors makes everything you hear on NHPR possible.
What color is water?
Well,
don't overthink this, Rick. When your kids'
concerns about oversight and care emerged after a series of
Do I look like someone who gives up that easily? No, we're going to continue to fight for the children of New Hampshire.
Your sustained support keeps New Hampshire informed, engaged, and keeps all of us connected. Learn more at nhpr.org/sustainer.
I'm Peter Biello, and this is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And with us now is 2020 Democratic presidential candidate and Senator Amy Klobuchar. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. Senator, welcome.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's just great to be on. I appreciate it. I'm excited to be able to be out of the Senate for 1 hour to talk to you.
You have been spending so many hours in the Senate. We've been listening here at NHPR. We've been offering live coverage of that. Senator, we want to give listeners a chance to ask you questions that are on their minds. So listeners, now's your chance. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email your questions, exchange@nhpr.org. Senator Klobuchar, you've referred to yourself as progressive but practical. So what do you mean by that?
I mean a progressive that can get things done. And the word progressive actually has progress in it. And my argument is that I'm a candidate really that offers two things. One, I actually pass bills and get things done. And I think that's what we want right now in a president. I've passed over 100 bills as a lead Democrat since I got to Washington, D.C. And I've been arguing from the beginning that this election is an economic check, yes. And that means everything from the rail that needs to be built to New Hampshire, to southern New Hampshire that this president has failed on, to the prescription drug prices, to student loans that really hit New Hampshire hard. But it is more than that. It's also a decency check. It is a patriotism check. It is a values check. And the people I meet throughout New Hampshire are constantly coming up, independents and others, saying, you know what? I don't agree with everything that the Democrats say in the debate stage, but I don't like this president. And so if we forget that, I think we lose the opportunity to win big and to bring with us independents like we have in New Hampshire. And my last case is I'm someone that wins like that. I win with a fired up Democratic base. I bring people with me instead of shutting them out. I govern in a way that is equipped to get things done. And I've done that in every single race I've ever won. I've actually won in the reddest of red rural and suburban districts in by sizable margins. I've actually never lost a congressional district in some very red areas, including Michelle Bachmann's district. So I think that matters to Democrats in this race. I think the fact that I'm gaining momentum in New Hampshire, received the endorsement of both a union leader and the Keene newspaper, it just goes to show the broad support I have and my ability to actually speak to the challenges of the day.
Young people in particular are leaning towards candidates who are proposing huge system changes. If you are the eventual nominee, what is your pitch to those voters who see you right now as a more moderate candidate?
Sure. Well, my first huge system change is really huge, and that is getting rid of Donald Trump. There is nothing more important for young people. Because the things that are going to be on their shoulders, climate change. He's done nothing. He's gone backward. To the young voters, I say this. This is my top priority. It's the first thing I'm going to do the first day, get us back into the International Climate Change Agreement, and then bring back the clean power rules and the gas mileage standards and introduce sweeping legislation to get us to carbon neutral. Second issue that that young people care about a lot is gun safety. They're really leading the way on that. I've been leading the way on it since I was a county attorney, and it's something that I care a lot about and have. In fact, I'm the lead on the bill to close the boyfriend loophole, which basically says that domestic abusers, convicted domestic abusers, can't go out and get AK-47s. And then finally, I have a proposal to make it easier to pay back student loans and double the Pell Grants, as well as making free 1- and 2-year degrees. And my proposals are a little different than some of the other candidates. Maybe we can talk about that later. But my pitch to young people is you can't have 4 more years of this president. So why don't we put someone at the top of the ticket that brings the receipts? Someone that actually can win in those hard areas, including in New Hampshire, where we have to win. Mm-hmm. Someone that can win in the Midwest. My plan is to build a beautiful blue wall around those states of Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, Ohio, Iowa, and yes, my home state of Minnesota, where Hillary had her lowest percentage of any state she won in, build a beautiful blue wall around those states and make Donald Trump pay for it.
Senator Klobuchar, we get this note from Carolyn in Ware, who says, thank you, Amy, for running. How would you repair the damage the Trump administration has done to relationships with our international allies? Carolyn adds, good luck in Iowa and here in New Hampshire.
Well, that's great of her. Thank you, Carolyn. I would, first of all, bring sanity back to our foreign policy. I believe that we should have a strong military. We know in New Hampshire, a very patriotic state where we have more veterans per person than we have in other states. So I know that New Hampshire gets that. But at the same time, we have to take on the challenges that are in front of us that hurt our security. One is cyber attacks, and that's something that I don't think this president has done enough.
But I just want to direct your question more specifically to international relations. Is there a conversation you're planning on having with other leaders around the world to sort of repair
of course,
those relationships?
Yeah, and I was getting to that. But remember, if we want to work with the rest of the world, we got to take on the actual challenges in front of us. And I was getting to that because one of them is international agreements. And this president has taken us out of several international agreements and then let our allies, who Caroline is referring to, hold the bag. And it's the same with cyber. So much of this have to be working with our allies. So in my first 100 days, I would meet with our allies, all of them. And this is a president that's, look at the Iranian agreement. He got us out of the agreement and he let Europe hold the bag and then gave all the leverage to China and Russia. I would negotiate ourselves back into the Iranian nuclear agreement. I would take on the Russian agreements. One of them is going to be lapsing the New START agreement right when a new president comes in. That is critical for the world's safety. And then, of course, there are others. There's another one as well that he let lapse. The International Climate Change Agreement, I already mentioned that. He seems to always stand with dictators over allies, tyrants over innocents. And so I think the combination of focusing on diplomacy as well as our military, which is why I started there, modernizing our military, focusing on diplomacy, because in the words of Ambassador Yovanovitch, it's literally been hollowed out because so many great people have left, and that means bringing people back. I'm pleased to have the support of Ambassador Jim Smith, who was the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, New Hampshire, a New Hampshire resident and leader, former Brigadier General. And I'm really proud to have his support.
Let's ask you, let's talk a little bit about the economy. We are in the midst of an unprecedented 11-year economic expansion. Experts say that's likely to continue. Consumer confidence is pretty high, labor market's strong. What would you say to Americans who say that this is reason enough to stick with President Trump, assuming he's acquitted in the Senate and can run again?
I would ask the New Hampshire mom who's struggling to pay for childcare that question. I would ask someone who has trouble finding employees right now in New Hampshire because there's no commuter rail with the most concentrated area in the country that doesn't have commuter rail. And I would ask someone who's working in the gig economy that doesn't have any retirement. The issue here is that it is not shared prosperity. It is not shared prosperity. And that's the answer is to take a bunch of the things that Donald Trump did to help the wealthy people, like his tax cut, where he went down to Mar-a-Lago and basically said, and these are his words, you all just got a lot richer. Take some of that money and put it into things that matter to the people of New Hampshire. Universal child care, helping to pay down student loans, making it easier for people to afford prescription drugs. So that's just one example, but it's really looking at the world in other people's shoes. There's an old story of Franklin Roosevelt. When he died, they put his body on a train. It went through America, and a guy was standing at the side of the track sobbing with his hat in his hand, and a reporter said to him, "Sir, did you know President Roosevelt? Is that why you're crying?" And the guy says, "No, I didn't know President Roosevelt, but he knew me." That is the problem with President Trump. There is not the empathy for the people out there that need the help. And so when you talk about him boasting about the economy, man, he is good at that. But what he doesn't ever talk about is how hard it is for people to afford things and how he hasn't kept his promises to the working people of this country.
Senator Klobuchar, we got this question from Doreen. She wrote in to say, "I agree with your policies, but haven't heard most candidates speak about our bad national debt. How would you tackle it without taking money from your social policies?"
Well, thanks, Doreen. That's another great question, and I would have predicted that I got that in New Hampshire. First thing I do is, by the way, I love working with both our New Hampshire senators, Senator Shaheen and Senator Hassan. They're good friends, and New Hampshire is one of only a few states that had the wisdom to send two women to the U.S. Senate. Minnesota's the other one. One of the things that Senator Shaheen has proposed is biannual budgeting, which means instead of just every year Congress basically extending the last budget, you give it 2 years so you can spend a year doing oversight and looking back at how things are spent. I think that's a really good idea, and I would push it through as president. Secondly, I'm the only candidate on the debate stage that actually has put together a fund, kind of like a rainy day fund, taken $200 billion out of that tax cut, add another $100 billion from various savings, and start on a deficit repayment to pay back that deficit so that we're in better fiscal shape. The third thing I do is that I show how I'm going to pay for every single thing that I propose. I think that's really important because we have a guy in the White House that's been treating the people of New Hampshire like poker chips in one of his bankrupt casinos.
Well, so
me,
would
they're
you,
my friends,
so
and
would you
I
be,
will make, I will get this done. Go ahead, sir.
Sorry. Would you be paying for these things in part with a tax increase? And if so, what would that tax increase look like?
Well, it's not going to be a tax increase on the middle class, but let me explain how I would do it. One, take the capital gains rate and go to the normal income rate with capital gains. You would maybe have a few provisions for long-held assets, but that would bring in hundreds of billions of dollars. Take the estate tax exemption, which was $3.5 million under President Obama. It went up to $11 million under Trump. Go back to where it was. That brings in over $100 billion. Close that oil giveaway. That's over $30 billion. Stop the hedge fund. That's over $18 billion that you bring in, the hedge fund loophole. Do something when it comes to those corporate tax giveaways. I wouldn't go back to where the tax rate was. I favored bringing it down a few years ago, but he went so low. Every point you bring back is $100 billion. Go back to the international tax rate the way it was under Obama. That saves $150 billion in 10 years. That's just what I have memorized right now for you. There are so many things we can do that will still keep our country in good fiscal shape, but help us pay down the deficit and also shift some of that money to the people, regular working people in New Hampshire that simply want to have help paying for their pharmaceutical drugs.
Senator Klobuchar, we got this question in our voicemail from a listener, and I will play it for you.
Hi, this is Andy from Pekin, and I wanted to know if the senator's statement is on the Minneapolis NAACP calling for her to resign, Black Lives Matter, due to her record as a prosecutor for one specific person who's been incarcerated for life, but there's been a bunch of articles that I've seen in The Hill yesterday about it in the last couple of days. Thank you.
So that's the question from Annie and Keene, Senator Klobuchar.
Thank you. So first of all, let's step back. I was the county attorney for 8 years in Minnesota, had a good reputation for fairness and working with the communities, worked with the Innocence Project on some major, major efforts to have eyewitness identification done in a more fair way, to do a DNA review of all of our cases, and I had a good reputation on nationally and locally for the work that I did. Secondly, this case is a case that happened back in 2003 where a little girl was shot doing her homework at her kitchen table. Three people were convicted of that crime back when I was heading up the office. I didn't individually handle the case. We have over 10,000 cases a year. And then he appealed that case. And when I was not county attorney, there was a second trial where he was also convicted. If there is new evidence in the case, and I appreciated that the Associated Press, I have publicly stated that this should be reviewed immediately. It must be reviewed immediately because the job of a prosecutor is to convict the guilty and protect the innocent.
Mm-hmm. There were other reports that over your 8 years as a prosecutor, you declined to prosecute upwards of 24 cases of accused police brutality or excessive use of force, while also being quite harsh on lesser crimes. Do you have a response to that accusation?
Yeah, I would say to look at the numbers. African-American incarceration rate went down 12% when I was county attorney, which is a major change. A lot of it was my emphasis on white-collar crimes as well as drug crimes. Also, with regard to the police cases, those were all given to a grand jury, so it wasn't like nothing happened. The grand jury looked at them, and My view of this now is really for all over the country at the time, that was the practice. And I think that one better way to do it, which I supported in, say, the Philando Castile case out of Minnesota, which is past my time as prosecutor, handled directly by the individual prosecutor making a decision about whether the police officer should be prosecuted. In that case, the evidence was there, and the officer was prosecuted. Unfortunately, the jury came back with a verdict of not guilty, but I supported that prosecution, which is probably the most prominent case coming out of Minnesota of a police shooting.
Wanted to ask you a question about the many bills you've passed into law. This is something that you talk about a lot, your ability to pass legislation that is either sponsored or co-sponsored by you and enjoys the support of Republicans as well. Is there one of those that you feel like you are most proud of?
Well, when the 35W bridge collapsed in Minnesota, that was a national disaster, not just a local disaster. It was a huge 8-lane highway. 13 people were killed. And we had to fix that. It was the biggest bridge in our state. And we got that built in, I think, 13 months, which was an all-time record. It was eight blocks from my house. And I got the funding for that. I led the way. I worked on a bipartisan basis and worked with the House of Representatives as well. And we got that bridge built. Sometimes the things you work on big, like the bill I passed on drug shortages or the work that I've done on broadband and on other issues. But sometimes it's a small thing. One of my favorite memories of a bill I passed was a very sad story of a girl that was maimed in a swimming pool with a malfunctioning pool drain. And I took that on. No one had really taken it on. It had stalled out in Congress, worked with her family, and we passed a bill that changed all the pool drains in the country. It may not be the biggest thing, but according to the Consumer Protection Agency a year or two ago, since we passed it, not one kid was killed from a malfunctioning pool drain. And it was because this family was willing to come forward. They went on TV, they told their story. And I still remember being back in the cloakroom, mm-hmm. calling that dad who just never gave up on me and telling him we passed the bill. Well, not a big story, but a lot of times if you've got a president that's willing to take on big things and little things, you got people's back.
Well, Senator Amy Klobuchar, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And just a note to listeners again, we were hoping to have Senator Klobuchar on for the full hour, but this is what worked for her schedule, given that she's quite busy now, especially with the Senate impeachment trial. But we did invite her and all the candidates running for president in 2020 for a full hour. Remember, all the conversations in our candidate forums and all our primary 2020 coverage exists online for your listening pleasure at nhpr.org. This is the New Hampshire Primary News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.